From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we'll hear from the family of an 8-year-old child who was allegedly racially taunted and hanged at a New Hampshire park.
I can never imagine in a million years ever saying to an 8-year-old child to put a noose around their neck or even joke about that, because the implication of death is in that rope. And I don't understand.
Also today, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos says the way colleges currently handle sexual assault doesn't work.
The results of the current approach, everyone loses.
But whom is it failing, the accuser or the accused? And WBUR's Asma Khalid is just back from China, and experts she spoke to there say the robots are coming.
The Chinese government is afraid they will lose their manufacturing volume unless they can augment human labor with automation.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There is a little boy in Claremont, New Hampshire, who is trying to heal from physical and emotional wounds of an awful incident that happened at the end of August. This little boy is 8 years old. He's biracial. And his mother, Cassandra Merlin, alleges that teens at a park used a rope from a tire swing. Her son got up on a table, and the teens put the rope around his neck. And, quote, another kid came up from behind him and pushed him off the picnic table, and they walked away and left him there hanging, end quote. Now, Cassandra Merlin told ABC News that her 11-year-old daughter was also at the park there watching and screaming while the little boy swung back and forth three times.
The fact that my son was biracial and these boys were of white descent, they continued even after the fact to make comments about white pride, even after the fact that they had hung my son.
Now, no adult witnessed what happened. And in the immediate aftermath of the incident, Claremont Police Chief Mark Chase told NH1 News that his department is investigating. But he added something about the juvenile suspects. He said, quote, mistakes they make as a young child should not have to follow them for the rest of their life. But what about her son? Cassandra Merlin asked. So she posted images of the child's deeply wounded neck on Facebook. And now a more significant investigation involving the New Hampshire Attorney General's office is underway. The town of Claremont is in shock, too. On Tuesday afternoon of this week, they rallied. Here's resident Leona Watt.
This doesn't start with children. You know, you're not born hating. We're not born hating each other. It's a learned behavior. So I'm just asking the parents, teach your children well, because this is not okay. And I just want Claremont, everyone to know, Claremont is not a town where you have free will to hate.
Claremont Police Chief Mark Chase was also there.
Racism and hate are not a thing of the past. I've seen it in my job. I've seen it in the reports that I've read, the reports I've taken as a police officer. I would guess a large number of people that are standing in this audience right now, here today, have also seen it as well.
Now, of course, none of this, the alleged actions and reactions, none of this is happening in isolation. That was a point made at the rally by Olivia LaPierre, a Vermont-based activist.
Quincy's case is a single story of a larger narrative, a narrative in which black and brown people are lacking some serious visibility in white rural America. We don't have a community to support us. We are out here alone, and most of our stories go unheard. We don't have a black community or a brown community to then go find support in.
And it's almost as if other members of the Claremont community tried to actually make LaPierre's point for her. Because listen to this moment from the same rally on Tuesday, captured in a report from New Hampshire Public Radio reporter Breida Green.
The event's organizer, Rebecca McKenzie, was just introducing the night's first speaker when she was interrupted by a white man driving by and yelling from his truck. All lives matter, he proclaimed, responding to Black Lives Matter signs in the crowd. Stop making it about race, he said.
But this is about race. Lyric Merlin is the boy's uncle. He was at his sister Cassandra Merlin's house just a little while ago today when we spoke with him. And I started asking Lyric how his nephew's doing right now.
He's doing well. He's a really resilient little boy. And I think that it will take some time for him to really, you know, the physical stuff is moving quite along. But I think it'll take him some time to get over the emotional aspect. He's a very emotional little boy. So, you know, it'll take some time.
Yeah. I mean, what happened was awful. It would take time for anybody, I imagine.
Absolutely.
And how are you? How's his mother? How's the family doing?
Everybody's trying to kind of pitch in and help in any way that they can. Unfortunately, Quincy's youngest brother has been really ill with a blood disease, so he has been hospitalized over the past week. So my sister's really been tied up there and making sure that he's taken care of, and trying to respond to so many people who are reaching out and really supporting Quincy.
Yeah, well, it does seem that the community is rallying around here, but I mean, what exactly happened? We've seen the social media reports, but can you tell us what you know about what happened?
Sure. So Quincy and his sister Ayana, who's just a little bit older than, were playing at the park across the road from my sister's house. Apparently, there were a couple of boys. I know that one of them is 13, and they're all around that age. And they had been taunting Quincy and, I guess, throwing sticks and rocks at him and calling him racial slurs. So apparently, at some point, they were each kind of taking the rope and putting it around their necks and were saying, oh, we've got to do this. And when Quincy put the rope around his neck, they pushed him off the table and left him hanging there.
How did he get down?
Luckily, sorry, I'm a little bit shaky because I don't repeat the story very often, but it's different than knowing it and reading it than repeating it. But so he was able to free himself, luckily, and he swung back and forth a few times. My niece was screaming, and she was obviously quite shaken up. And luckily, it was not tied well, and he was able to free himself and fell to the ground. So very lucky.
So he had to be hospitalized.
Yes.
And from what I understand, and his mother was there when he was hospitalized, right?
That's right.
Was he able to tell his story to law enforcement then at the hospital?
I believe at Dartmouth-Hitchcock he was able to. And I don't know what the story was for Valley Regional, because I know that immediately they needed to make sure that his airway was clear. Yeah. And he was in a neck brace. And they transferred him to Dartmouth-Hitchcock via the medevac because they were worried that his airway might close on the way up there. So they didn't risk taking him via ambulance before the transfer.
Yeah. How do you feel the reaction has been from law enforcement so far?
You know, honestly, when I first talked to my sister, I said, you know, what's going on with this? And she said, they said that there's not enough evidence. And I said, well, I don't even understand how that could possibly be. And they had kind of been brushing my sister off. And it wasn't until, you know, more people got a hold of that Facebook post that she and I had posted that anything even began to turn around and look more on the positive for any type of justice for him. You know, and it's a real shame that it had to take the word getting out for them to even take this seriously.
Yeah, because now New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu has said that the New Hampshire Attorney General's office has sent a team to Claremont to help with the investigation.
I did hear that.
Yeah, and that he said hatred and bigotry will not be tolerated in New Hampshire. Has that helped things? Are things moving along in terms of an investigation better for your family?
They seem to be. And my sister, of course, is trying to be as patient as she can. But, you know, being stuck in the hospital with Junior, it's been really difficult for her. You know, they've assured her that, you know, this is moving forward and they're getting the help that they need. But it is really disheartening to see some of the articles where, I think it was the police chief who stated that, you know, he's almost trying to make the perpetrators the victim. You know, not at all did they express any concern about Quincy himself. You know, they're more saying, well, we don't want this to follow these boys around for the rest of their adult lives.
Right. I mean, this is something that the police chief told NH1. He said that these people need to be protected. Mistakes they make as a young child should not have to follow them for the rest of their life. Right. That.
And where is Quincy's protection? You know, this will be something that follows him for the rest of his life, undoubtedly.
Yeah. Do you or your family members know the families of the other children allegedly involved in this?
No, we don't.
Mm-hmm.
You'll have to excuse me. That's okay.
I am. Who was that? What was that?
Sorry, that was the captain from the Claremont Police Department asking for my sister to come to the police station to talk to the Attorney General, and he said he'd like to strike this while it's still hot.
What does that mean?
I'm not really sure. That quote by itself is a little frustrating. Strike it while it's hot. I mean. Yeah, I don't understand that at all.
Okay, so Lyric, just so I'm sure, so the person that you were just talking to, because while you asked us to wait, was someone from the police, from the Claremont police?
Yes, it was Captain Brent Wilmot.
Okay, that was the captain, and he said that he wants your sister to come meet the Attorney General today.
Yes.
Okay, but she's, of course, at the hospital with her younger son.
She is, and he said, well, she was supposed to be here at noon, but... That's why I explained to him, the hospital isn't working on anybody else's time. They kind of, you know, they have a whole team, interdisciplinary team they need to get in touch with in order to discharge a baby, so.
Okay. Well, look, I don't want to keep you on the phone too much longer because I presume you're going to want to call her. That this is happening. But listen, can I just ask you two more quick questions? Is that okay?
Yes, of course.
So it seems like there's a lot going on right now. But I have to say, what does it feel like in the community there? Because did this come out of nowhere, or has there been like racial tensions in Claremont before that just didn't really rear their heads?
You know, it's hard to say, really. We moved here from San Diego, and when we moved here, we were from a completely different type of culture. It was certainly a culture shock. And even back then, when Cassie and I were in high school, there was a lot of that towards even us, because we, you know, we just weren't from this area. And there was a lot of racial things that went on with just a few of the kids that were black in the neighborhood here. So it was kind of a whole new life for us. We couldn't believe that there was any kind of divide because we hadn't lived that way. We lived completely in blended communities. So, you know, it's hard to say. Is it one of those things that's a little bit more hush-hush? Certainly, but it is present.
Mm-hmm. And if you had the chance to speak with the young people allegedly involved in this, what would you tell them?
I'm not even sure. I've never even thought of that once, I guess. But, you know, Quincy he's going to turn 9 on the 20th of this month, and he could have easily not been here. And I think that they need to understand the magnitude, whether they're telling police it was an accident or not. There is no accidents when it comes to losing someone's life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's really unfortunate that it had to come to this for them to even understand the potential value of a little boy. And I just don't even I don't understand it.
Yeah.
He's a baby compared to them. I have a 14-year-old daughter, and I could never imagine. And my 14-year-old daughter is biracial, I might add. I can never imagine in a million years her ever saying to an 8-year-old child to put a noose around their neck or even joke about that, because the implication of death is in that rope, regardless of anything. And I don't understand.
Yeah. Well, Lyric, thank you so much for talking with us. I don't want to keep you on the line any longer, because I know you should probably need to call your sister about the police captain's visit. But thank you, and I hope things get better, okay?
I thank you so much.
That's Lyric Merlin. He's the little boy's uncle. We spoke with him just a couple of hours ago. Now, we also reached out to the police chief of Claremont, New Hampshire, the town mayor, city manager, and other New Hampshire state officials. No one was available to speak with us, but New Hampshire Congresswoman Annie Custer did send us this statement, which includes, quote, "The reports that this was potentially a race-based act of violence underscores the need to gain a full understanding of what happened. I'm encouraged that Governor Sununu is offering the resources of the Attorney General's office to the Claremont Police Department to assist in the investigation of this matter. We must be vigilant in always combating hate and intolerance wherever it appears," end quote. There's more Radio Boston in just a minute. Let's take a quick 60-second break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos made waves last week when she announced the Trump administration, would be reexamining current policies on how colleges handle allegations of sexual misconduct.
The truth is that the system established by the prior administration has failed too many students. Survivors, victims of a lack of due process, and campus administrators have all told me that the current approach does a disservice to everyone involved. That's why we must do better, because the current approach isn't working.
But isn't working for whom? That's what I wonder. So joining us now is Lee Burdett Williams. She's the former dean of students at Wheaton College in Norton, Massachusetts. And she joins us today from Vermont Public Radio. Lee Burdett Williams, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Also with us in the studio is Colby Bruno. She's senior legal counsel at the Victims' Rights Law Center in Boston. Colby Bruno, it's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
So let me start first by asking both of you. I mean, obviously there's been continuously a great deal of discussion on how to best handle the issue of sexual assault on college campuses, renewed now because the education secretary is stepping in saying the current system isn't working. So my first question to both of you, do you agree or disagree with her? Lee Burdett Williams, let me just start with you. Is the current system working?
No, not as well as it needs to work for such an important issue.
And why do you say that?
Well, I think that there are a number of contradictions and inconsistencies in the expectations of the federal government for the way that colleges respond to sexual assault allegations on campus. But aside from that, I think that the issue of sexual assault on campus is enormously complex. And I think the more we try to fit it into a process, a very mechanical process, the more we'll be frustrated by those complexities, kind of the human condition that students bring to their interactions with one another.
Okay, so I should just remind folks that you are the former dean of students at Wheaton College, so you probably had to deal with this issue quite a bit. But Colby Bruno, same question to you. Do you think the current system is or isn't working?
I think the current system is working with reservations. I think that the way that we look at rape and sexual assault on campus cannot be too linear in that we can't just look at the conduct process, or we can't just look at the Dear Colleague letter or the 2001 sexual harassment guidance as conduct, right? Because it's not only about the ramifications if you violate a code of conduct. It's about prevention, education, training. And so there's so much richness to all of these guidances that I think we do lose it when we focus exclusively on conduct procedure.
Okay. So there's a lot to dig in with both of you, but the Dear Colleague letter, Colby, remind people what that is.
So in 2011, the Obama administration published a guidance which went out to every single president of every single university in the United States. It was intended to be, from what I understand, a clarification, further guidance on a 2001 sexual harassment guidance document.
Okay. So here's what I want to do. I want to step back here for a second, because for people who aren't deeply enmeshed in this issue, things might get kind of confusing, because there is guidance from the federal government. There are there are systems on college campuses that may vary from campus to campus. So let's step back this way and sort of set the table here, because Secretary DeVos herself, in her speech, you know, she described her view of what the current process generally is on a lot of campuses to handle allegations of sexual assault. And, you know, in her speech, she noted that students who have been victimized, she said, are often urged to keep quiet or even discouraged at all from reporting the assault at all. And then that wasn't right. And then she said that if it is reported, things might go through an administrative process at the college. And here's how DeVos described what that process is.
If there is a hearing, both the survivor and the accused may or may not be allowed legal representation. Whatever evidence is presented may or may not be shown to all parties. Whatever witnesses, if allowed to be called, may or may not be cross-examined. And Washington dictated that schools must use the lowest standard of proof. And now this campus official, who may or may not have any legal training in adjudicating sexual misconduct, is expected to render a judgment that changes the direction of both students' lives. The right to appeal may or may not be available to either party, and no one is permitted to talk about what went on behind closed doors. It's no wonder so many call these proceedings kangaroo courts.
That's the Education Secretary Betsy DeVos describing what she believes is the process at many colleges and universities in handling allegations of sexual assault. Colby Bruno, you're giving me a face. You don't like that description.
I just think that the secretary has a fundamental misunderstanding of what the Department of Education and the Office for Civil Rights does. Because if she is concerned with the enforcement that schools are not keeping up their end of the bargain as it relates to the compliance of Title IX, then the Department of Education is the body that enforcement has to come from. So if all of these colleges and universities are not complying with Title IX, pre-Dear Colleague or post-Dear Colleague, I don't care, it's still Title IX, then it's the Department of Education's responsibility to enforce that and to find violations and to provide additional guidance so other schools can follow that.
Okay, you said a hint of that earlier, that you see it's the federal government that's not doing its job to enforce guidelines that are already in place.
Enforce guidelines that are already in place and understand what guidance is in place, right? So she talks about people don't have training.
Yeah.
That's a clear violation of Title IX. Title IX requires that decision makers have training. And the Clery Act requires annual training.
Okay.
So there's a lot of things that in that list that sounds very, inflated to me, because the way that Title IX works is it does require each of these things. So it does require equity. So if there is a hearing, there should be a hearing. And if there's not, then it's a violation of Title IX.
So, Lee Burdett Williams, I haven't forgotten about you. let me turn back to you again. You're former dean of students at Wheaton College. I mean, react to what Colby's saying, that she believes that all the pieces are in place. It's just a matter of enforcing the guidelines that are already there, and we should have a system that would work on college campuses.
Right. Well, I'll start the same way that Colby did. I think that Secretary DeVos has a fundamental misunderstanding of how things work on a college campus. And that, for me, has always been a major conflict between the expectations of federal expectations and institutional realities. And I think what's frustrating, one of the many things that's frustrating about the direction and instruction and guidance that schools get from the Office of Civil Rights, the Department of Education, the Department of Justice at times, whether it's through guidance in a Dear Colleague letter or the many communications they send out to try and explain something like the Dear Colleague letter, there's not a lot of input coming from those of us on college campuses who are trying to deal with the reality of student interactions and a conduct process. Even listening to that segment of the Secretary's speech, I'm really struck by how she is using the language of the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. And that's not the language that we try to operate with on college campuses.
Can I just jump in here? Because to that point, I wonder, most of the people who have to go through this process, I presume, are 18 or and above. Mm-hmm. Why are we even asking colleges to be the adjudicators in this case? Like, why isn't it just directly sent to local law enforcement?
That's a great question, and it's one that is asked over and over again. And so I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to answer it. When a student comes to the dean's office or the Office of Student Conduct or campus safety and makes an allegation that she or he was sexually assaulted, we could, if we listened to our critics, say, you know, we're not really equipped to do anything with that. You need to go to the police and make a complaint there. And we're not going to touch this because it's really not in our wheelhouse. But the reality is that some of those allegations, the police would not go very far with, or a district attorney's office would not choose to bring charges against the alleged assaulter.
Is it because of different standards when we turn to the external criminal justice system?
Right. So if we look at the definition of sexual assault and sexual harassment, we have on our campuses kind of developed such an overbroad definition of what those things may be that the police would look at a narrower definition, and the police will take on those cases. But the other thing that you have to consider is the timing. So under Title IX, we are expected to respond to any concerns about a hostile environment on campus immediately. If a student alleges that she or he was sexually assaulted and says that they feel unsafe on the campus with the alleged assaulter also there, we have to act almost immediately to respond to that concern.
Yeah.
And that might mean removing the alleged assaulter from campus without the process even beginning or very early in the process. And that's one of the complaints that a lot of alleged assaulters have.
Well, if I can just jump in here, because I want to get Colby Bruno's take on this as well. So I hear that potent reasons why these things are handled on campus. But Colby, what's your take on this?
So I think at the basic fundamental pieces of Title IX, it's equity in education. So when one individual is subject to sexual harassment, that individual is denied the access to the benefits of having an education on that college or university. And that could mean one incident of rape, or it could mean multiple incidents of sexual harassment. And so Title IX was supposed to be formulated so that every single person had equal access to that benefit of the college. But what was happening was people were being raped, disproportionately women were being raped, and there were health consequences, economic consequences, educational consequences.
Life consequences.
Life consequences for these victims. And it wasn't turning anything upside down. It just, there was a clarification and, you know, and there was a guidance. And I mean, I absolutely agree with Lee about the timing of it. You know, I think what people don't often understand is that criminal cases can take 4-5 years uh-huh. just sitting there. Now, you're at college, and college usually takes just 4 years. So by the time something is ever resolved, you are done with college. So you need to figure out, or the college needs to figure out, how you as a victim can have equal access to your education, just like the accused has access to his or her education.
So I want to know, is there a better way? Because Lee Burdette Williams, you were saying a little while ago that you have many concerns with the current system and the guidance provided by the federal government in terms of how colleges should handle cases of sexual assault. And I was interested to hear you say a little earlier that one of your concerns is that it doesn't take into account the complexities of life on college campuses. But do you see a better way? Is there some hybrid between a college tribunal and external law enforcement? I mean, I don't know. Are we sort of stuck with the system that we have?
I hope not. The secretary actually mentioned a number of ideas that have been put forth for alternative approaches to this. Interestingly, all of the examples that she shared came from attorneys, and that's an important voice, but it's not the only voice in this process.
One example she gave was about creating regional centers,
right?
And this would be a school would refer to the center any Title IX allegation that they believe would rise to the criminal level.
Right. And that's a great idea in theory, and I have tremendous respect for Gina Smith and Leslie Gomez, who have been talking about this idea for a number of years. The problem is that little thing that you said at the end about if it rises to a criminal case, it's not a bimodal situation where it's either a criminal case or it's not a case at all. Sexual assault, it occurs on a continuum. And at one end of the continuum is the kind of rape that is clearly, absolutely, unequivocally a criminal situation. But in a dean's office, in a student conduct office, in a counseling center's office, we are dealing with cases that might not rise to that level of a criminal misdeed.
Yeah, can you hold on there for a second, Lee? Because I want to get Colby to respond to that, because I think you're hitting on something, one of the many things, but something important that makes this so difficult and complicated. Because Colby, I mean, as Lee just said, there's a continuum. And even saying that, I know some people react very strongly to that and say, no, it's like assault is assault is assault. But what's your take?
I promise I will not jump across the table at you. That is the thing. I do believe that assault is assault is assault. Nevertheless, on college campuses, I know that people understand or people think that it gets murkier because there's alcohol involved. Mm-hmm. And that is the elephant in the room that everybody wants to talk about, and no one knows what to do about it. And, you know, it exists, and we discipline students for it, and we discipline students for other things while they were drunk. I think that when you are in front of a hearing panel, and I've been in front of many representing individual students, and you are talking to the victim and the victim is giving the story and, you know, and is giving it over and over again, and their witness accounts are fairly consistent. And then the alleged perpetrator comes up and gives three separate accounts and three separate writings, and the witnesses don't really know. I don't think that that is a difficult thing to adjudicate, because when you're talking about and you're looking at the evidence here and you're looking at what the stories are and the credibility factor, you can adjudicate that. So for me, the current system, yeah, needs some tweaking, but we have so many phenomenal building blocks in these guidances and so many opportunities. I mean, there's a whole list of of colleges and universities that are under investigation now that have been under investigation for 4 and 5 years.
For Title IX violations.
For Title IX violations. Why not start publishing some resolutions to try to help people figure out some guidelines? It is rife with problems. Do not get me wrong, but I am not the person that will say that things get murkier when there's alcohol. I think that an individual person, when they are assaulted, they know exactly what happened to them. And there is no benefit to them for bringing forward a false allegation when they are actually a victim.
Well, we're fast running out of time here. And Lee Burdette Williams, I want to let you have one more crack at this here. Closing thought or response to what Colby said?
Well, I wish that all cases were as clear-cut as the one that Colby describes, where you have a perpetrator who is really uncredible and you have a survivor who is extremely credible. That's not always the case. Alcohol is not the only thing that causes murkiness. It's 18, 19, 20-year-olds engaged in sexual activity and relationships that are complicated and on a campus with enormous social pressures. All of that leads to murkiness. And, you know, I would ask, what if it's the opposite, where you've got a perpetrator whose story is absolutely consistent from start to finish, and someone who is accusing that perpetrator whose story changes? Is that not assault is assault is assault? So to be in those hearings, to be trying to parse out what's going on with students is way too complicated for a simple answer.
You know what I want to say? I want to say thank you to you both, because I do think that even in the complexity of this conversation, we get a feel as to why this is so challenging right now. And for better or for worse, the Trump administration says it's going to do something. So as the Department of Education moves forward with whatever it does on its guidance regarding a college sexual assault, we will have that conversation. We'll continue to do that. So for now, let me just say thank you to Lee Burdette Williams, former dean of students at Wheaton College at in Norton, Massachusetts, joining us today from Vermont Public Radio. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate your paying attention to this very important and difficult topic.
And Colby Bruno, senior legal counsel at the Victim Rights Law Center in Boston. Colby, thank you as well.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There were once few public services for people with physical challenges. And in today's Remembrance Project, writer Alyssa Eli recalls the life of one Massachusetts man who was once institutionalized for being blind.
The early facts of Bobby Dolan were the facts of a sad life, born mostly blind with seizures, an abusing father, sent incorrectly to a state institution for the mentally retarded when he was only 12. Retelling his story for the Massachusetts Association for the Blind, Bobby described his 38 institutionalized years. "Somebody suggested to my mother that they put me in Munson State to see if they could cure me. Oh, Christ, they were going on like madmen over there." The hospital was severely understaffed, and Bobby actually took care of a few wards, shaving and bathing other patients. It was a grave misuse of him, and yet it was also a source of self-esteem. In Bobby's mind, he kind of ran the place. Deinstitutionalization freed him in 1974 when he was close to 50. 4 dismal decades in the state hospital were followed by 4 liberated decades in group homes. His roommates had also been deinstitutionalized, and some needed to learn their own names or how to brush their teeth. But Bobby was flush with competence.
He had power and influence in his circle, you know, and was looked up to, and he was the ringleader. And he got his way.
Barbara Salisbury, the CEO of MAB, understood his effective charm.
And he got results in a bureaucracy where it was, like, really tough to get, you know, results.
His feisty activism was often on behalf of others. When Bobby was working in a sheltered workshop and decided he had the right to retire, he lobbied for others to retire, too. If staff in the group home was inattentive to other clients, they heard from him. Then there was Teresa. He'd first met her in Munson State.
And Teresa, you know, was the light of his life. And he would spend a lot of time taking Teresa to the Busy Bee on Beacon Street, you know, which is a fabulous place. His big thing was taking her out to eat, you know. He would take her to the KFC in different towns. He thought that was the height of, you know, a great evening out.
These were deep pleasures.
The thing that I was most amazed about Bobby is when I asked him if there was anything he would change about his life. And he said, not a thing. Not a thing. For his 90th birthday, he had a fabulous birthday party at the house, and everybody came, and you know, and he had these fabulous flashing glasses with guitars, you know, on the top, and he was having an absolute wonderful time.
He had changed his sad facts, and he had thrived.
Writer Alyssa Eli, remembering Bobby Dolan, who died in March at the age of 91. To suggest someone for a remembrance, email remember@wbur.org. All right, finally today, let's step away from Boston and go to Beijing and then back to Boston again, because that's roughly the itinerary that WBUR's Asma Khalid followed. She leads our station's business and technology team, Bostonomics, and she recently went to China on a whirlwind 10-day trip, and we want to hear all about it. So hi there, Asma.
Hey, Meghna.
All right, so China, one of the biggest, fastest-growing economies in the world. Giant power.
Mm-hmm.
What is most relevant, or what did you sort of take your, what did you see through your Boston lens when you were there?
So Meghna, you know probably that I've been reporting on robotics and on automation here in Boston, and I realized in some of my conversations that there are really fascinating and sometimes intimate links in this industry between Boston and Beijing, and not just Beijing, but other cities as well. And a couple of months ago, I heard about this unusual venture capital firm in Cambridge called InTeahouse. Pretty much everyone who works there is Chinese. Its mission is to foster tech collaboration between Boston and China. It was founded a couple of years ago by a woman whose name is Xin Lu. She's this petite, really energetic woman who's lived most of her life in China. And she told me that this firm is focused on building relationships between Boston and China, specifically in the life sciences, clean tech, and robotics. They're essentially trying to connect local entrepreneurs with markets and money in China.
We build the connector, is a connection with local entrepreneurs and international investor. If you need to raise money, if you need to fund the market, if you need to fund the partner in China factory, we help you.
That's everything, she says. They'll help them find, you know, factories, partners locally in China. And last October, they took about a dozen local robotics companies on a trade mission to China. She told me this Saturday, they're actually taking a whole another bunch of robotics companies as well.
Okay, so are some of those companies or any Boston-based robotic companies making inroads in China?
There are. I spoke to a few that actually went on this trip to China. I think for a lot of them, this was a new market to explore.
I see.
But before I went to China, I sat down with Rod Brooks. He's the CEO of a relatively new robotics company called Rethink Robotics. It designs this arm that can be used in manufacturing facilities. He told me he started shipping to China just last year. And I asked him why, you know, what was the appeal in branching out to China?
We saw that there was a labor shortage in China, and electronics manufacturing was not going to move away from China, no matter what anyone says. So we went to where the market is. Now,
okay, so Rod Brooks, Rodney Brooks.
Correct.
Yeah,
iRobot. Former director of MIT CSAIL.
One of the fathers of robotics. So not just the new robotics company.
Yes.
You're being humble.
His company is really interesting. Okay. And to me, like, what's interesting about them, too, is, like, you know, you're right. Rod Brooks is this legendary man in robotics, right? So everybody knows him in China who's working in this industry. But for me, what was interesting is for him entering the Chinese market in this way in sort of a commercial aspect seemed relatively new.
Yeah. You know? Well, and so I should say what he said in that piece of tape that you just played for us is really interesting. That they're seeing a labor shortage in China, and there's an opportunity for robotics there?
So, Meghna, this is something I heard repeated by almost everyone I spoke to in China, and people would point to a couple of reasons why they would say that the one-child policy means that the average 18-year-old, that sort of the number of 18-year-olds has been declining the last couple of years. Some people also spoke to me about mandatory retirement. So, you know, here, if I go into a manufacturing facility, I often see people in their mid-50s. Uh-huh. That's not the case, and I visited a few different factories in China. You see people who are 20, 21, they're really young.
Wow. Okay, so tell us more. Where did you go then and more about what you saw?
Sure. So I started in Beijing where I attended the World Robot Conference. It's really unlike anything I have ever seen. There were thousands of people there, researchers, you know, company execs, but a lot of kids as well, because on the periphery there are robot contests for these kids. there were lectures. It was just this really sort of dramatic scene, right? And I actually want to play you just a bit of the intro music because it will help you understand what I'm trying to say. In Freeman in Chinese. It's this sort of sense of how important the robotics industry is. They went on to explain how this is really the future and how they, you know, need to invest in this industry. And there was this massive expo hall with robots of any sort you could imagine. I mean, there was literally a life-size robotic version of the Chinese basketball star Yao Ming. And it was here at this expo that I actually spotted a booth.
Wait, did you just say there was a life-size robot Yao Ming?
Sorry. It was one of those normal things that you saw so many. But it was also, Meghna, here at this expo that I saw a booth for Boston-based Rethink Robotics. Tina Tang is a woman who works for their local distributor in China. And she said, you know, they have a few of these robots at Foxconn and at Amazon locally there. But she said it's also been a little tough because there are quite a few domestic Chinese robot companies that are popping up. And she also talked to me about this plan called Made in China 2025. I don't know if you've heard of this, but a couple of years ago, China's president Xi Jinping announced that essentially as a way to encourage advanced manufacturing in the country, China was going to invest heavily in AI and automation. It's essentially a government mandate, and the government is pouring millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, into this. And so Tina Tang talked to me a bit about what that means for Rethink Robotics.
Generally speaking, the Made in China 2025 policy is good, because we have more opportunities to be exposed to the public. But comparatively speaking, because Rethink is a foreign brand, it won't get the same strong support from the government as the local brands. Every year, there are hundreds of robotic companies emerging. The best ones win, the bad ones are abandoned.
So, Meghna, she actually speaks in Chinese, so you'll hear I had a translator there.
Yeah. And so you also went to Shanghai.
That's right. And there I was actually looking at something that I would say you saw apparent, not just from the conference, but pretty much everywhere. And that is that the country is really undergoing a robot revolution. There are companies there that are on a mission to become fully automated. And so in Shanghai, I met Jerry Wong. He spent years here in Boston at MIT, did his PhD from here. But around 2000, he moved back to China to start his own telecoms company.
The manufacturing companies in China is really more and more facing the pressure of the labor costs. It's getting difficult to competing with lower cost factories in like Southeast Asia.
Fascinating.
I know, right? Because everybody here talks about how presumably it is so much cheaper for companies to do their business in China. And then here you have a guy from Shanghai who's saying that, well, for them, labor costs have been increasing. And he told me that he pays his workers about $1,000 a month, which is just really high. The cost has been increasing exponentially every year. But it's also what we heard before from Rod Brooks, you know, who spent years at MIT. He says that essentially it's just that there aren't enough people in the labor pool and he can't even find enough folks.
Yeah.
to do the jobs that he has.
So in the last couple seconds that we have, Asma, this is absolutely fascinating because, of course, you know, here in the United States, Massachusetts is a major center of robotics. We're a leading creator of new robotic technologies. So what were the biggest takeaways for you from what you saw in China for Massachusetts?
So, Meghna, I would say that in a nutshell, it's just the idea that nationalism and automation are intimately connected, right? It's a public policy. And I felt like when I was in China, there's this vision of a space race when it comes to automation and robotics, except really they're in the race. And at times, you know, with the exception maybe of Boston, the greater United States doesn't always see it as a race.
Wow. Well, that's Asma Khalid. She leads WBUR's Bostonomics team, talking to us about what she saw on a recent trip to China. You'll hear more of her reporting on that on WBUR. Asma, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.